It's funny, just because we created Reddit to be this anti-establishment place, and now I'm the establishment.
Welcome back to Cargo Cult.
Welcome home.
I'm Naomi Caravani, obviously.
And I'm Michelle Greenstein, obviously.
You know how on TikTok you can tap and hold like the corner of your screen to fast forward? And I'm a big fan of playback speed control in general. I mean, I think it's tragic and dystopian and a reflection of, you know, our shrinking attention spans, but I obviously use it because I have a very shrunk attention span. But anyway, I was on Facebook time yesterday and I caught myself trying to do it for a second.
Come on, bitch, spit it out.
I was like, get to the fucking point.
Yeah, that's the trouble with FaceTime. It's live. And real life. Really can't speed it up.
There's an update in the New York Times lawsuit of OpenAI. And this story is a very like devil you know versus devil you don't kind of story, because obviously we're not huge lovers of the New York Times here. I mean, like right now we're talking about it because it had the Mossad or like IDF propagandist write an article. And
yeah, you can't have a lady who's like, their insects annihilate them all, write an objective article about October 7th. That's not, just not a thing you can do.
It's just the most recent example of just a long list of times the New York Times has basically been a stenographer for power. But it's kind of tricky because it's not like OpenAI is going to not be stenographers for the ruling class and, you know, is gonna do something completely different than the New York Times. It's just a different like kind of set of technologies. It all ends up being like the same mishkababble of people.
Mishkababble.
So, yeah.
I love that.
You never heard
Yiddish?
That? I'm so surprised you never heard that before. Yeah, I think it's Yiddish. It's something I learned in my Orthodox Jewish upbringing. So don't say I didn't keep any of it. I may reject the Zionism now, but I the lingo.
The funny thing is, like, on the Israel side, there's a lot of people who are mad at the New York Times for saying that actually Israel did bomb Al-Shifa, and they were like, the New York Times is run by Nazis.
Run by Hamas. Yeah, no, I mean, the really hardcore Zionists don't fuck with the New York Times either. That's definitely true. New York Times is, like, pretty much aligned with the Democratic Party, give or take. So last week we mentioned that the New York Times is suing OpenAI and Microsoft, right? Because Microsoft not only is the sole cloud computing provider for OpenAI, and like these companies are extremely intertwined. Microsoft like did a lot of the technological foundation for what OpenAI does now, but also Microsoft invested at least $13 billion in OpenAI Global LLC, and Microsoft is going to receive 75% of OpenAI's profits until that investment is repaid. And after that, Microsoft's going to own a 49% stake in the company, right? I'm repeating myself a little bit, but if you didn't hear our ChatGPT episode, we talked about how looking at OpenAI is like this new small company is like really not the way to look at it, right? They like to position themselves as like, we're coming in to change how things are done. We don't fuck with big tech, right?
In its origins, you do have these wide-eyed, you know, techno-optimist scientists who founded OpenAI and who were at odds with Microsoft at some points.
And that's like a very nice marketing story. And it's just another, this is like kind of what this whole episode's going to be about, because we're going to talk about this with Reddit. You can have a group of well-meaning people, but under the system, whenever a company gets, you know, to a certain level of influence and size, it ends up getting swallowed by that system, right? And so like, yes, in the beginning, OpenAI was like, all of our code is going to be open source. Like they had all of these great visions. What do I want to say?
Yeah, visions.
Yeah, like values. Anyway, New York Times suing OpenAI and Microsoft, accusing it of using millions of articles without permission. So the New York Times complaint lays out this claim of copyright infringement, and they're highlighting the substantial similarity between New York Times articles and ChatGPT's outputs, right? As we mentioned last week, the New York Times is the single biggest proprietary data set that's being used to train GPT. So some of these side-by-sides are pretty damning. They gave 100 different examples of GPT-4 just generating these long excerpts from Times articles. And when you look at the side-by-sides, It doesn't look great, right? It doesn't look great for OpenAI. Some of the examples, I was like, oh, interesting. They chose to move this sentence to the end of this paragraph instead of it being the beginning of the next one.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same.
So it's like, how could the New York Times not win this?
Yeah, the side-by-sides don't look good. And according to Cecilia Zentini, a Silicon Valley IP and AI lawyer, this is the best case yet, alleging that generative AI's output is copyright infringement. But OpenAI just responded. They're asking a federal judge to dismiss parts of this lawsuit. They're arguing that the New York Times, quote, paid someone to hack OpenAI's products. And they're using the word hack, which is, I'm assuming, just designed to generate headlines. They say that the New York Times has caused the technology to reproduce its material through, quote, deceptive prompts that blatantly violate OpenAI's terms of use. The New York Times clapped back. They responded and they said, quote, what OpenAI bizarrely mischaracterizes as hacking is simply using OpenAI's products to look for evidence that they stole and reproduced the Times copyrighted work. What's important is that OpenAI's response, that filing, doesn't dispute that they copied the New York Times works to build its products.
Yeah, which is crazy because it's like you can just take from a paywalled site and spit it into your machine.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they just have to buy one subscription.
Yeah, it's just one chatbot.
But they use 12-foot ladder.
Yeah. I think I am subscribed to the New York Times because if you threaten to cancel so much, they'll just like give you a subscription for pennies. So,
but it's funny because it's like OpenAI copying New York Times material. The New York Times is like kind of low key doing a copyright infringement on the State Department.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, where did you get that?
Right. It'd be funny to do a side by side like State Department press releases.
What I'm suggesting is another lawsuit brought to OpenAI saying that they've made the chatbot so dumb that they're like Thomas Friedman spitting out, you know, ways to fix the Middle East. Like, just treat it like a jungle. The Arabs, they're insects.
Yeah, if you might ask ChatGPT, give me a good analogy for the Middle East.
Yeah.
Just verbatim the Thomas Friedman opinion piece.
So, yeah.
Anyway, more legal news. Google just cut the contract for a group of contractors who work for YouTube Music after they went on a prolonged strike.
Ooh, I didn't hear about this.
I work for YouTube Music in Austin, and I'm a member of the Alphabet Workers Union, CWA Local 9009. Even though we work for two Fortune 100 companies, we are paid just $19 an hour at a job that requires a bachelor's degree and 3 years of experience working in the music industry. Everyone in this room can agree that that is not a livable wage in this city. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are less than 50 of us at YouTube Music, and we're taking on two of the largest corporations in the world. So to be supported by the city of Austin and also our allies in the labor community, give us the motivation to keep this fight
not
going.
Not to interrupt, but they just laid us all off.
Oh.
Yeah, they just laid us all off.
We just all,
our jobs are ended today, effective immediately.
Wow.
So this team consisted of more than 40 Texas-based moderators employed by Cognizant who were responsible for approving music content for YouTube Music, right? As we know, YouTube is owned by Google. Google's owned by Alphabet. Alphabet's owned by, I don't know, probably the Rothschilds. I don't know. I'm kidding. Okay, so they were demanding changes to Google's return to work policy, saying that many workers who were hired to work remotely are paid as little as $19 an hour.
Cognizant is the contracting company.
Yes.
And they have a union.
There's a union that's trying to bargain with Google. And Google's like, what are you looking at me for? Look at Cognizant, right? Because Cognizant is technically the employer. This is what the dispute's about, right? Who's the boss? So Google's saying, we don't need to negotiate with you guys because you're not Google employees. We shouldn't be considered your employer. Cognizant's your employer. Cognizant should be bargaining with your union. And the workers are like, actually, you have enough control over us to be considered a joint employer. So you need to bargain with our union, basically.
It is disgusting that Google has taken this path when confronted with its workers' modest demands to be treated fairly on the job, said contractor and union member Jack Benedict in a statement.
And so the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board.
Very good.
Thank you. Is that right?
Yeah.
The NLRB ruled in March 2023 on the side of the workers. They're saying, okay, because Google controls the benefits, the hours, and the direction of work for these contractors, Google should count as a joint employer. Google is a partial employer, right? Mm-hmm. So then Google appealed that, but then the NLRB upheld the ruling in January and is basically saying, like, your refusal to bargain with these workers is illegal.
I mean, it's just so depressing to think about, like, even working for Google. Once upon a time, you'd get amazing perks in the cafeteria, and now it's just like you're a $19 an hour contractor. It's like, what is the point?
Yeah, if I'm not getting the ping pong and the beanbag chairs.
Yeah.
But I mean, we talked about this in the Google episode, but like how they had no walls in the office and like,
oh, well, I know one or two things about an open office environment. The boss will always see you shopping. But I mean, it's in his interest for me to be shopping because that means I want to make more money to buy the sofas that I'm looking at.
That is actually brilliant. Yeah. But it's just like Google is so big now that so many of the people effectively working for Google actually don't work for Google. It's all of these contractors, which is like a way to, you know, not have to give people benefits and also to limit your own liability as this behemoth that we know as Google. I mean, like, this is the group of moderators living in Texas moderating YouTube Music.
Wow.
And they clearly have, you know, a shitty situation, and I feel for them. But what they're going through is nothing compared to the hordes of people in India who are doing, like, quote unquote, support for Google, who are also not employed by Google, right? Like, when you're a conglomerate this big.
Yeah, it's no longer work from home. It's like work from the halfway house slash prison that your employer, who says you're indebted to them, has provided you. It's just, yeah, tech work world seems to be looking more and more grim.
Yeah, exactly. All right, moving forward, should we do Reddit news?
Yeah. Reddit, where you can get your morning news or nudes, whatever you're in the mood for that morning. It's not just the home of school shooters and, you know, red-pilled MRA guys. Like, it has 3 times more views than Fox News and 5 times more than the New York Times. Like, a lot of people come to Reddit for their news.
So last week we mentioned that Reddit has filed to go public and trade on the New York Stock Exchange. This is going to be the first major tech IPO of the year, and also the first social media IPO since 2019.
Pinterest.
Yes. Nice.
And are they like a successful company? I feel like it's just all women who are like deciding on the like tablecloth designs for their wedding.
I mean, that's a big market.
I'm designing my proposal.
My wedding proposal, which will be me on one knee pointing a gun.
Actually, I got that from, there's like a old photo of a actress doing that, proposing to her boyfriend, but I'm like, I relate.
Okay. So everyone's talking about Reddit right now because of the IPO. This week it came out that they're seeking a valuation of up to $6.5 billion, and they plan to price the shares between $31 and $34 a share. Mm-hmm. And your boy, Sam Altman, is going to make a bunch of money because the current shareholders include Advanced Publications, which we're going to explain a little bit later, Tencent, and Sam Altman. In that order. So the number one shareholder is Advance, number two is Tencent, and Sam Altman is the third largest shareholder.
Yeah, it's interesting how Sam Altman is also involved in this company. There's a lot of trepidation going forward. They're worried about how the moderators on the site are going to affect the company's profitability. I mean, Wall Street Bets, you know, the famed subreddit that was responsible for the GameStop frenzy, has said that they're going to be betting against the stock and trying to short the stock. And also, it's important to mention that the thing that makes Reddit good is it doesn't have those kind of engagement algorithms that push content to the top. You have users that either upvote or downvote And it's a very democratic system that might disappear as this company tries to become profitable.
Yeah, it's like now they kind of need to become profitable. They're kind of forced to cater to potential investors. And the users, as we'll see, are going to kind of become secondary in Reddit's mind. Reddit kind of started with this user-centric ethos,
kind of anti-establishment themes, the belief in the open internet,
and, you know, being all about community and democratic ways of sorting content, like you mentioned with the upvotes and downvotes. So we're going to cover the history and founding of Reddit, the anti-establishment qualities that the site had in the beginning of being super democratic, and then we're also going to tell a little bit of the story of them selling out and kind of becoming that establishment. It's actually funny. There's a quote by Steve Huffman where he says, you know, it's funny how Reddit started as this anti-establishment thing and now I'm the establishment. And he does this as a joke, obviously, but it's funny because it's true.
Okay, so Reddit goes all the way back to 2005. So they've had a lot of staying power, right? They're older than Twitter. They're a tiny bit younger than YouTube. I think 6 months younger. And Reddit really started with this ethos of community, right? The mission was to, quote, bring community and belonging to everyone in the world. And like we said, it's very impactful and large. 76 million people visit the site daily. And it's really a good window into people's opinions, which is really great.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, there's comment sections on YouTube videos and there's a comment section on every Facebook post and all of that. But Reddit is
just comment.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, now, you know, they rolled out images and videos or whatever. But like the spirit of Reddit really lies in debate and discussion.
What makes Reddit successful is that user-generated and user-moderated content.
And the success lies in non-employed forum moderators, really, right? Like, because the moderators or curators or whatever, they have control over the subreddit.
These are people who are attorneys, they're computer engineers. You have to really respect how they have another job totally based on internet glory, totally based on getting these coins and getting their karma up. A research paper that was published last year found Reddit moderators approximately work 466 hours per day. And that would cost Reddit a minimum of $3.4 million a year with a, you know, modest wage of $20 per hour. So there's a fair amount of free labor.
The mods and the power users and the people who are on Reddit the most,
and who run the site. Yeah.
Yeah. The people who, like, obviously most people use Reddit, like, you know, is this vacuum a good vacuum? And then they use it like maybe once a month.
Is this ant a bed bug?
But it's that small minority of people who are really on Reddit that make Reddit as good as it is, right?
Yeah. But anyway, terminally Redditors.
Yeah. So let's talk about the origins, the history, the timeline, the founders. Where do we start? Let's start with Alexis and Steve.
Steve Huffman and Alexis. How do you say his last name?
Ohanian,
who's married to none other than, what's her name?
Serena Williams.
They're UVA doormates.
Yeah, the official story is like they bonded over a shared love for video games.
Oh, yeah. How unique.
Because by the time I got to college and I met Steve, who lived across the hall from me, freshman year, very typical sort of founder meeting story. I don't know, I was on move-in day, and I thought, I hope there are more people who like video games here. And I look across the hall, and there's Steve playing PlayStation 2, and I was thrilled. I really didn't think people played video games in college. I was very naive. And I was thrilled to meet him, obviously, because he was a gamer.
a dorm relationship. I wonder what they were playing. They were probably playing in 2005. GTA already? Civilization.
Okay. What about World of Warcraft? When did that?
Yeah. I mean, I played that and it's like first iteration on a PC. Mid-90s.
One of my really good friends, Anna, her older brother was really into World of Warcraft and I had a crush on him. And so
you respected the video game? You were like, oh, well, he's learning geography. He is raising an army. He's learning a lot about the materials.
I was so young, though, that like I didn't get the appeal at all, because to me it's like, let's play, but all he wanted to do was sit at the computer. I couldn't comprehend how that could be fun. Anyway, moving forward. So Alexis and Steve and Alexis.
Probably bonding over Resident Evil, which is a survival horror game. So yeah, it's like first person shooter. They could have like, they had two roads to go down after their love of shared love of video games. Do they go into computer tech or do they join the IDF? They made, you know, the choice that a lot of Americans made during that time. And there were a lot of people who got rich during this time. Like, people were just constantly dropping out of college and getting rich. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, it was the big,
You're like, the dropping out of the college part? I guess.
I mean, wow, what's that like?
Is that why you did it? Is that why you dropped out of college? You were like, I could. What's your origin story?
Well, I dropped out of college because I got an offer to teach Hebrew at this school in Chelsea. It's so funny because looking back on it now, it really wasn't that much money. But at the time, the offer was more money than I had ever had in my life. I'd only ever...
They were like $15 an hour. And you were like, wow.
That's what I was used to, because I had worked like as a line cook, as a waitress, a dog walker, a babysitter, all that stuff. So I was used to 15.
All the jobs I have right now.
So to me, it was like, obviously, I'm going to do this. I'll take a gap year. But I just never went back.
I didn't know you knew Hebrew well enough to teach it.
Well, I was teaching fourth grade.
Oh.
So, you know, it's conversational. But I was actually at one point fluent in Hebrew. It's definitely a use it, lose it situation. Mm. Or don't use it, you lose it situation. But I went to Orthodox Jewish schools from preschool all the way to eighth grade. And we learned Hebrew. And we also learned, of course, that Israel is our home and the Arabs want to kill us.
All the good stuff, all the hits.
So Alexis and Steve, after they bonded over video games, decided to build something together. And their first attempt at a company was called Mmm.
Oh, what? I thought it was My Mobile Menu.
My Mobile Menu or Mmm.
Oh no.
Yeah.
What a terror. So yeah.
Took off.
But it was like primitive Uber Eats. That's what it was. It was like you could order from restaurants with a text message.
Exactly. It was over text instead of as an app. So anyway, they start they go to Paul Graham, who we're definitely gonna have to do half an episode, if not an episode on at one point. They go to hear Paul Graham at Harvard to hear him speak and try to talk to him. They ask to buy him a drink.
Hey, Paul, we've got $1 million idea. What if you sent text messages to the Subway sandwich artist?
And Paul kind of fucked with the vision of this reminds me of that Trisha Paytas clip.
Dr. Graham, I would love to take you out for a coffee. Steve and I have come up from Virginia and want to pitch you on a company. And he said, sure. Yeah, okay. We pitched him on that night. He loved it. He loved it.
After speaking with them, Graham invited them to apply to Y Combinator, but the pitch was rejected. But on their way back, Paul called them and was like, okay, we may not like but we like y'all. So you guys should abandon and start brainstorming a new idea. And so they did.
Yeah.
I read it on Reddit.
Yeah, that's how they got their name. I suspected that was the case, but yeah, it is disappointing as a name origin story.
Well, actually, one of the names that they almost landed on was Oobaloo.
Oobaloo? Is that Yiddish? This is for lazy men. He's an Oobaloo. I don't know.
Fucking Oobaloo. What's this Oobaloo want?
Yeah, Oobaloo would not have taken off. There is like something sinister sounding in the name though, don't you think?
Oobaloo. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I think anything with a double O is going to land in the spooky. Anyway, moving forward.
You're doing a great job.
Okay, so Reddit. So the basic idea of Reddit is to aggregate all of the content on the internet in one place. Remember, this is 2005. You know, there's no like main kind of like aggregator. There was a site called Delicious, not to be confused with But they thought they could build something better.
That's dinner. Just like.
And at first, remember, Reddit was just one page with a bunch of links. Like, there was no system to categorize it.
Yeah.
They made this basic version live. Paul linked to it on one of his blog posts, and that's how they got their first few users. Some users came to it.
Oh, yeah. But those first few users were Steve and Alexis. A lot of the first users on the site. So yeah, they had to astroturf all this user-generated content at first. And then eventually they started to see screen names they didn't recognize after a while. And they were like, oh, hey, is that you, Steve? No, that's not me. That's like Bumblegum 49 is not one of my aliases.
Well, shit, we have a real user.
That's that's like a real milestone in your startup is like, we have our first real user.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real fake it till you make it vibe, because eventually real people did come. So Paul's blog post brought some people, but it still wasn't like popping off the way they wanted it to. And so they created these hundreds of fake users to make it more populated. Again, fake it till you make it. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, we salute.
But again, remember, it's just a list of links, right? But then they introduced subreddits. You know, on the internet at the time, there were basically all these different forums for different topics, right? But by introducing subreddits, they were telling people that, like, you can all come here. Like, people don't have to go to all these different websites anymore. All of your communities can come gather on our site. Then they were like, wait, like, instead of us creating these subreddits, because we're kind of getting bombarded with all these requests for new subreddits, why don't we let other people make their own subreddits? And so they did that in 2008.
There was a Chocobitch. There was rape jokes.
Okay.
There was a great purge of many of these pages after they, like, made national headlines for sharing revenge porn and celebrity porn.
Yeah, gotta rein that in. And RNSFW, don't forget the first ever subreddit.
Was that the first ever subreddit?
It was.
Oh, NSFW, cool.
Our AMA was better when it was just like regular people. Now I feel like it's just a lot of celebrities.
It's like Barack Obama.
I enjoy letting my boyfriend fuck other men while I watch from a neighboring apartment. Ask me anything, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a consensual cucking, but
now it's just like, I'm Bill Gates. I'm trying to rebrand myself from a monopolistic and predatory tech billionaire into a philanthropist who just wants the world to be healthier in a pink sweater. Ask me anything. But
yeah.
So we talked about Alexis and Steve. There's also another kind of co-founder, Aaron Swartz. I mean, I don't know. There's debate as to whether he's technically a co-founder or not. He joined 6 months later. Aaron had this other company called Infogami that also wasn't taking off.
Yeah. So Aaron Swartz at the time was like working on a kind of primitive Wikipedia.
Yeah, which is Infogami.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was like a progressive. He became a really huge critic of corporations. He wrote something called the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto.
Which, yeah, definitely, if you think you're doing anything slightly illegal, though, don't write a manifesto. Like, that will be used against you.
He was instrumental in the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which, like, was trying to help get progressive candidates elected across the country. Anders would love him.
No, yeah, Anders does love him. But I also worked for that Progressive Change Campaign Committee.
Nice. But in terms of his contribution to Reddit, he was a very skilled programmer. He was kind of like a prodigy.
Mm-hmm.
He became like well known in like the early days of the internet and all these tech circles when he was literally a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah. I mean, he helped develop RSS when he was in his early teens.
Literally.
It was like in his late teens, he like already had moved on to this primitive Wikipedia idea. So yeah, and you may know Aaron Swartz as like in 2013 he committed suicide when he was facing felony charges for downloading JSTOR articles. He was very committed to the open access internet and believed that maybe the public should have easy access to publicly funded research. Very groundbreaking point of view at the time. And what's sad is Now you sign up for JSTOR and your first 100 articles are free. And now you're hacking JSTOR by like creating another email address to get those free 100 articles. So he paved the way for a lot of open access ideas and that we're like benefiting from, even though at the time he was treated like a hacktivist and made an example of by the Obama administration. His first foray into like downloading for open access was the Pacer technology, which was a system by which you would get legal documents.
Yes.
And you would have to pay for them, and they charged
it. Can I just say something?
Like,
as someone, I've been a paralegal. I've also been a journalist, right, where I sometimes want access to court documents.
Okay.
Pacer can suck my ass. Like, you'd think the law
would be,
all things would be public.
Yeah, you don't know if you're breaking the law because you got to pay to figure out if you've. It's like a poll tax.
So there was the thumb drive core, which was like a bunch of organizers basically saying like, this is fucked up. Like Pacer shouldn't be, like we should all have access to court documents. So go to your local libraries and start downloading things and put them onto thumb drives and then upload them. And we will, you know, make them available to everyone. And Aaron was instrumental in that success because he, you know, is great at coding. He automated the process because basically in response to organizers saying like, this is fucked up, that Pacer is not open to everyone. Pacer was like, okay, fine, we'll make it open to you. But the way they did that was like, they just did it in a handful of libraries across the country. Mm-hmm. Like not everyone is near. So the thumb drive core was like, okay, like you should go to the libraries and download it and then we'll put it on our website. And Aaron helped conduct the like massive automated parallel downloading of all these court documents. And so this was his first experience being harassed by the FBI. They like went and staked out his parents' house.
And they arrested him and roughed him up. Like somebody who was using a thumb drive from things he got at the library. Like that's...
Yeah.
Insane.
All he did was make law public.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's interesting. They, of course, didn't choose to pursue this because it would be totally hypocritical to do that. But in the case of JSTOR, people are still asking why the government did this because their JSTOR, first of all, dropped. Charges withdrew from the lawsuit and the government still decided to pursue this case.
Yeah, so basically all the major universities pay licensing fees to JSTOR in exchange for being able to access the journal articles. And so students can all access these articles, right? Aaron comes at it from this perspective of like, we need to kind of like liberate it, not only for the developing world, but also for people who may not be in university. Like this should just be information that is out there for anyone to read. If you think about it, like these universities, a lot of them get government grants. A lot of that is taxpayer money. So it like becomes this like asinine, like, system of like, you know, locking the general public out from information that actually they kind of helped fund. But anyway, so he thought it should be available to the public. Some people say he also had this like secondary goal of analyzing all of the academic papers for evidence of research being funded by industry and then industry-funded research producing biased results, which if true actually makes sense why they went at him so hard, because that's not good for corporations.
Mm.
So he went to MIT because MIT is one of the major universities who does pay the licensing fees in order to access the JSTOR articles. And he got all the information from the MIT servers.
But yeah, and he was also allowed to access. Like he was a research fellow at Harvard at the time. So he was able to access the MIT computers. That was not the illegal part of it.
Yeah, they charged him with 13 criminal counts of federal crimes, including wire fraud and computer fraud. But anyway, back to Reddit. After Aaron's death, Aaron's name was removed from the Reddit website.
Mm.
Leadership at Reddit could have taken this as an opportunity to do like some sort of tribute to him. Or, I mean, at the very least, they could have done nothing. But to remove his name and like now pretend he didn't exist and it's just Alexis and Steve and kind of erase him from the origin story, like, I think was the first sign that Reddit was straying from its anti-establishment origins.
Within the context of Reddit, it's important to realize that a lot of these, you know, true believers in Reddit, the ones who are operating the site, like, they really are committed to his memory.
Yes. They say, to this day, they say Reddit was born out of this belief in the open internet. That's a quote from Steve. He says, the founding spirit of Reddit is that the mainstream media is not the best source of information. In fact, the
media... Ooh, what a take. Spicy. Yeah.
To this day, Spez still talks the talk.
Freedom. Spez is his username on Reddit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You're like, you know, Spez. You just, we read about Reddit for 3 days, and now we are power users. We know Spez very well.
Back it up, back it up. So Steve Huffman's username on Reddit is Spez. He is currently the CEO of Reddit, but hardcore Redditors know him as Spez. They know him as one of basically the moderators of the entire site. Anyway, another reason why Reddit is good is that there's a level of anonymity there. And that means that people kind of have to engage with what's being said only. And you could, of course, dox yourself. You could say, I'm Naomi Caravani, ask me anything. Yeah. But most users are anonymous. And so it creates this culture of discussion and debate.
Yeah.
And so that anonymity is, I think, one of Reddit's strengths. I mean, I'm not saying it's true anonymity. You don't have anonymity from the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, or Reddit themselves, or AWS, because AWS is the cloud computing service provider for Reddit. You don't have that kind of an anonymity. But in terms of the depth of conversation, the anonymity is really a strong point of Reddit.
Do you go on there and argue?
No, not really. I go on there to basically read about the TV show I'm currently watching. I love spoilers.
It's your way of pressing on the screen to...
People make fun of me for this. If I'm watching something, I mean, I don't do this if I'm with someone else. I'm not a psychopath. But if I'm alone and I'm like checking out a show or something, I will literally right arrow my way through an episode
just to see if you're interested. You're like,
no, this is me consuming.
You're like looking for Adam Driver, like, are there ugly actors?
I just spend a couple seconds in each scene to get the gist of it.
And you're like, oh, I watched that episode of Seinfeld. And
no, Seinfeld is different because Seinfeld, you're watching for the vibes and the jokes. But dramas, like things that are plot driven and suspense, whatever, it's like, I don't have 8 hours to watch this season right now. I know. Not a single person that I've ever disclosed this to has been sympathetic or agreed even a little bit.
I just don't understand what you're consuming. You're just like, oh, there's a couple kissing. Now they're angry at each other. Now it looks like one is dead.
I'll write arrow until I know what his problem is. Okay, what's her problem? Okay, moving forward. Okay, there's a fight. I don't need to sit here for 20 minutes and watch them struggle. Who is?
What show did you watch like this? The Crown?
I haven't seen The Crown.
Just name a show you did this for.
Blacklist. Fleabag, I did it with. The Good Wife, I did it with. Here's the real breaking news. Barry, I didn't do it with the first season, but I did the second and the third.
Oh, damn.
It's not moving.
That says a lot to the writers of those seasons.
Normal people. Oh, I did this with Sherlock.
Oh, normal people definitely could be that.
My boyfriend at the time went out to get us food, and I started the show, and I just moved through the episodes, and by the time he got back, I had seen the whole show, and I cried. It still worked for me. Yeah. I cried at that show multiple times.
You cried even though you were like, what a tableau of human emotion I just witnessed.
That's so funny.
But the funny thing is, like, you spared your boyfriend from watching Normal People.
Prison Break, that show really.
No, oh, I didn't
gotta watch that by fast forwarding.
That's sad. Yeah, that's just like the quality of TV that's being made right now. I mean, I did really like Normal People, but
I loved it.
A lot of fluff.
Like, oh, she's seeing him again. Oh, he's jealous. Oh, like, I get it. Like, let's move forward, please. Let's move forward in the episode as well.
Yeah, we need to do that.
So we talked about anonymity and like how it's a focus on like discussion and debate. But then we start to see, you know, as things get bigger, they start to sell out. And Reddit literally sold out to Condé Nast in 2006.
And why would a magazine publisher like Condé Nast be interested in a site like Reddit? Well,
The user-generated content is free. You don't need to pay anyone for the content and the curation of the content.
Reddit sells to Condé Nast in 2006. If you're in media, you know Condé Nast. They're a behemoth. They own Vogue, GQ, Vanity Fair, Bon Appetit. They're like the magazine people. Pitchfork, Wired. So they were kind of making this bid to move into the digital space. Oh, The New Yorker, AD is owned by them. Allure, Glamour, right? So they own all of these publications and they wanted to buy Reddit.
I wonder if all their money comes from just tours of mansions. The Architectural Digest. Oh my God.
It's all about video. These all used to be just paper magazines, right? So they wanted to buy Reddit. Aaron, of course, did not fuck with it since, you know, we know a little bit about Aaron now, right? Very anti-establishment, obviously against giant conglomerates. And so he kind of like butted heads with Alex and Steve about this. But ultimately, the deal did go through and Condé Nast bought Reddit for $10 million in 2006.
And Aaron was there for a little bit after the purchase.
Yeah, well, almost immediately after, bye-bye Aaron. He leaves in 2007. Officially, this is an undisclosed reason, but it's almost certainly because he like doesn't fuck with Condé Nast. He even blogged about hating the corporate environment like right after they moved into the Condé Nast office. So bye-bye Aaron in 2007. And then shortly thereafter, bye-bye Alexis and Steve in 2009. They both left when their contract with Condé Nast was up. Almost immediately after, Reddit decommissions its servers, which it owned, and migrates to AWS.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really done an AWS episode yet, but fucking the whole world runs
is on AWS. Yeah.
And so like we're saying, we start to see, you know, changes get introduced. So Condé Nast introduces monetization in 2009. Obviously, I mean, if you know Reddit's core, like, and most active users, they were repulsed because they were like, what the fuck? You're selling out. This whole thing was supposed to be about authentic community.
Now you're selling me shampoo. Like, I can, but it's like, just grow up. Like, your app is going to have ads. It's fine.
Yeah. And this is why I say the most active users. It's obviously 90% of people who are on Reddit are, again, they're just there to be a normal person and then they'll visit this site every now and then. But the most active users are the ones that are like, what the fuck? Like, you're acting like just another corporation. Like, this is supposed to be about community, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so they launched two different ways of advertising in 2009. We have sponsored content and the self-serve ads platform. So we started to have monetization on Reddit. Then in 2010, they introduced the Reddit Gold Benefits Program, another revenue stream. Basically, you know, you pay for an ad-free experience. Now it's just known as Reddit Premium. They restructured a little bit in 2011. They moved to Advance. Advance Publications is the parent company of Condé Nast. So they're no longer Condé Nast's child. Now they're Condé Nast's sister, I guess.
Okay.
And then, like, kind of in this period, like, we find that, like, Reddit, like, can't keep a CEO, can't stay out of scandals. They get a new CEO in 2012, Yishan Wang.
Yeah, 2012 is the year that it starts making national news that there's, like, revenge porn and celebrity porn on Reddit. And one of these really high-profile stories was the story of Violent Acre is one of these moderators, these super powerful moderators, and he like created hundreds of subreddits. And one of these subreddits was jailbait. So like pictures of underage girls, rape jokes, creep shots, which is like pictures of, you know, women walking up the stairs, I assume. Choke a bitch was a popular one as well. And eventually, Gawker actually started investigating who this guy Violent Acres was, who was creating all these crazy subreddits. And they contacted this computer engineer in Texas by the name of Michael Brooch and said, hey, we're about to tell the world who you really are. And he begged Gawker not to. And eventually Gawker published the article and Michael Brooch lost his job and as a computer engineer and was outed. And then CNN brought him on to talk about, you know, why he was doing this. And it's just kind of funny, the
the lower third is like, Reddit troll speaks out. And it's like, we speak to a real live troll. And this is, yeah, this is how the public saw Reddit at the time, even though, you know, Reddit, you know, a lot of people were just going to Reddit for news, but there was this kind of like idea of the cesspool of the internet. Like, I guess where the Reddit's reputation has like kind of softened, like Reddit was seen as 4chan.
Yeah.
Around those years, like it was where you could watch, you know, videos, snuff films and stuff like that. But anyways, let's watch some of the CNN segment.
I would love to.
360 exclusive. Now, if you spent time online and read comment sections of websites, you've no doubt seen some pretty vile, offensive comments written by anonymous people saying things they would never actually say if their names were posted. That's free speech, of course, and people have a right to say whatever they want. Often these people are referred to as trolls. We aren't editorializing when we use the term trolls. It's an internet slang for troublemaker. Well, tonight you're about to meet one of the biggest trolls on the internet, reviled for his pornographic posts. He's speaking out tonight in his first television interview. If there are kids in the room right now, you might want to have them leave. What you're going to
So I'm just going to skip ahead to like how this real life Reddit troll, Violent Acres, also known as Michael Brooch, got his start on Reddit.
The way he looks is like exactly the stereotype.
Yeah, he's like exactly what you imagine.
Basement, like,
yeah. I mean, he's like married with children, but like he is exactly
what does that have to do with anything? It's an aesthetic.
Yeah, he's like the dad from South Park who's like going on online at night and you know saying mean things to women. But yeah, Reddit troll speaks out is the lower third. It's beautiful.
Of this.
So this is how he got his start.
I started off posting lots of porn and mostly softcore porn, you know, pictures of naked girls, that sort of thing.
I love how he's like describing this as if it's his resume. He's like, I had a prolific career. It started off.
And as I'd find porn of different types, like if it was a picture of an African-American woman, I created a Reddit called Women of Color. If it was, you know, a woman with large breasts, I created a Reddit called Boobies.
He's like, is he so proud of himself for how he's like, look, I was in the mines separating boobies from women of color.
I saw it as creating folders to file things in. I created probably 600 Reddits or sub forums in the time I was on Reddit. And I just put things, you know, as I came across images, I put them in these categories. There are hot button topics that you can make a comment about and just enrage people. Sadly for me, I enjoyed doing that. I liked going in and making people really mad over what amounted to meaningless things.
He also takes out the award that Reddit gave him since he was such a prolific moderator.
This is the Reddit, the little Reddit alien. And this is actually a gold-plated, they only gave these out to people who had made significant contributions to the site. It's plated in gold.
You're kidding. Wait a minute.
I am not
this
kidding.
Is an award you got from Reddit for from creating Reddit. Jailbait?
Yeah. There was a famous court case recently about like how a woman tried to sue a guy like taking pictures of her like walking up the stairs up her skirt, and like since she was in public, like those photos are totally legit, like he can take them. So creep shots is not as illegal as it sounds.
But yeah, I mean, like to this day Spez talks about, you know, the power of freedom of speech, and like as long as you're not in violation of our policies, we're not going to limit your speech. But of course, we see that being applied selectively, as we're going to get into a little bit later when we talk about like propaganda a little bit more. Like, okay, creepy stuff, fine. But as soon as you start posting too much pro-Palestinian content, That's yeah. when we will restrict your speech. That's when we do really stray from what they call the founding spirit of Reddit, right? Which is, you know, free speech, open internet, blah, blah, blah. So that video is 2012. Yishan Wang is like the face of that as CEO. He resigns in 2014. 2014, we get Ellen Pao. She resigns in 2015. And like we kind of find that like Reddit, it's just like scandal after scandal, right? Because this is like the heyday of like traditional mainstream media kind of going after digital media, social media, right? You can't trust them. You can only trust us. And like the internet is a place for incels and rapists, but like CNN is a place for like serious journalism and like truth and reporting, you know?
What? But Ellen Pao also resigns because of a moderator. So there's a number of moderator revolts. So since they hold all of this power of the site, they will revolt. And when that CEO fired, Victoria Taylor, who was the public relations person, she was like one of the few people to help Reddit get like some legitimacy and, you know, got Barack Obama on the AMA and kind of helping Reddit climb out of the bad reputation of the 2010s, trying to make it more legitimate. And so, yeah, a lot of moderators shut down their subreddits, and the site's no longer useful if you don't have access to Ask Reddit and TIL and pics and stuff.
So Ellen Powell resigned because of?
Because of that user revolt.
Right. So after, you know, Yishan Wang resigns 2014, Ellen Pao resigns 2015, Alexis and Steve are like, all right, we're coming back. Alexis comes back as executive chairman. Steve comes back as CEO, Spez. This is where we see like Reddit kind of like try to modernize a little bit. They start the iOS and Android apps,
which are not very good. And a lot of those power users use third-party apps.
So we talked a little bit about the ads, but then also we have the issue of the API pricing, right? So in April of 2023, Reddit announced that it would begin charging for access to its API, which is basically what allows other apps and sites to get data from Reddit. So they're charging 24 cents per 1,000 API calls. And an API call is basically every time you interface with Reddit, every time you get data from Reddit. So every upvote, a downvote, a comment, opening a DM, accessing, like opening an image, like every single time you interface with Reddit to get data from Reddit as a third party, that's an API call. So obviously, if you have a big app with a lot of users making a lot of API calls, you're going to start to owe Reddit lots of money.
One of the pushes to get people to pay for API, Twitter also did the same thing under Musk. As more and more data scraping is happening because these generative AI companies, they need a lot of data. Where do you get that data from? Not just the web. They've already inhaled everything. So the new data is coming from these user-generated sites where you can scrape data like Twitter and like Reddit. And some of these third-party apps were, you know, scraping Reddit conversations about Israel and Palestine and, you know, selling them to OpenAI and other AI companies. And one of those companies was pushshift.io. And that's one of the things that Steve Huffman liked to point out was like a lot of companies are like profiting off of things that we could be profiting off of and actually make this company profitable after, you know, 20 years in business.
Yeah. So they announced this API change in April. First with no price information, but then 6 weeks later, they say it's going to be 24 cents, right? 24 cents per 1,000 API requests. So obviously there's a lot of anger, backlash, outrage, organizing. People are saying, well, first of all, it's too expensive. And also that it's too sudden. Like you're not giving us enough time to kind of get our ducks in order. Some of these third-party apps, you know, are really popular. And Reddit didn't create its own iOS app until like 2017, 2018, maybe 2016, something like that. Like for a while, you had to use these third-party apps. And here's the key point, right? You have to give some of the credit for Reddit's success to these third-party apps. Like YouTube bans third-party apps, Instagram bans. Like it's not normal to give your API out to the public, right? So like credit to Reddit for doing that in the beginning, right? But also YouTube, Instagram, they didn't have third-party apps to thank for their staying power and rise, right? They always had their own apps. Reddit didn't have its own app for so long, and the third-party apps helped Reddit grow. Apollo was one of the most popular ones. There was Relay for Reddit, which I think was Android only.
And one of the most important things is that, like, moderators would use it. So imagine you're a lawyer by day, gold star Redditor at night. I don't know what they would call the best Redditors, but this is what allows these people to do this job for no money, you know? I don't know if I should be defending these moderators. There's a lot of corruption among the moderators, too. There's moderators that have been discovered to, you know, hawk a certain product or allow, you know, the promotion of a certain product under their Reddit. Like, these people are not angels.
Also, those stories get the most attention. Like, you got to give partial credit to these third-party apps for making Reddit so popular because so many people use phones. And they did not start in 2017 when Reddit came out with its own official app, right? Another big complaint by the third-party developers, largely led by Christian, who was the developer of Apollo, was that, you know, we did not get a lot of warning for this, like I kind of mentioned. We don't have enough time to figure this out. We're going to now have to eat these costs. So a huge part of the issue was the timeline. And this is what you see people getting really upset at Spez about, because he's kind of course, become the face of this as the CEO. So Spez has been like the face of this, right? And then on the other side, the face of the third-party developers has been this guy named Christian, because Apollo was one of the more popular third-party apps for Reddit. Spez is like, you know, doing calls with all these different developers. He has one with Christian. Basically, Spez is saying the yearly opportunity costs, because users could be on the official Reddit app, and not the Apollo app for having Apollo running, is $20 million a year. Christian jokes, or he says he's joking, but Christian says like, oh, so just if you're saying this is costing you $20 million a year, just give me $10 million a year and we can call it a day and we can all like kind of run off into the sunset. And I don't know if there's connection issues or what, but Spez is like, wait, say that again. And Christian like kind of says it again. And Spez is like, say it again. And like, there's kind of just like this confusion. And Spez is like, are you like asking me to buy your silence? Like, he thinks that he's threatening him. He's like, this feels like a threat. I'm going to be really honest with you. And Christian's like, no, like, I'm joking. Like, we can go quiet because my app is very loud right now. And I think Spez heard like, we're kind of creating this revolt and like bolstering all the criticism of Reddit. And we will quiet that down as leaders of this revolution if you give me $10 million.
Oh, wow.
So do you want to hear the audio?
Sure. So this is Spez and a moderator, Christian.
This is Spez and Christian, who's the developer of Apollo. And Apollo has become the face of the like
API, yeah.
Anger, backlash. Yeah, because Apollo is one of the more popular.
Yeah, that's what the moderators use.
Yes.
Hey, I could make it really easy on you. If you think Apollo is costing you $20 million a year, you cut me a check for $10 million and we can both skip off into the sunset. That's mostly
true. 6 months of you.
I'm saying, if you're saying...
You said mostly a joke, but I want to take everything you're saying seriously just to make sure I'm not... What are you
referring to? I'm saying that if Apollo's opportunity cost currently is $20 million at the 7 billion requests and the API volume... If that's your yearly opportunity cost for Apollo, cut that in half, say for 6 months.
No.
Bob's your uncle. But anyway.
So you cut out right at the end, right? And I'm not asking you to repeat yourself for a third time. You legit cut out right at the
end. No.
If your opportunity cost is 10 million, and then I lost you.
So okay, no, sorry.
One more time.
One more time. I was just saying, if the opportunity cost for Apollo is currently 20 million a year, and that's a yearly, apparently ongoing cost to you folks, if you want to rip that Band-Aid off once, have Apollo quiet down, 6 months.
Yeah.
Beautiful deal. But again, this was mostly a joke. I'm just saying that if the opportunity cost is that high, and if there's something that would make this easier on you guys, that could happen too. But I'm just saying, as is, it's quite difficult.
I hear you, and I understand that you're
like, as an illustrative example.
It's just I think it's I don't know what you mean by quiet down, because I find that to be.
Sorry. I didn't mean that.
I'm going to be very straightforward with you, too. It feels like a threat. And like, I'm just like, oh, interesting. Because, you know, one of the things that we were trying to do is to say, hey, you have been using our APIs free of cost for many, many years. And like, we have absolutely sanctioned that you have not broken any rules. And now we're changing our perspective for what we are telling you. And I know you disagree with it, that, hey, we want to operate on a thing that is financially, footing. And so, you know, hopefully you mean something completely different from what I said. But when you say, like, go quietly, I just want to
How did you take that? Sorry, could you elaborate?
Oh, like because you were like, hey, if you want this to go away, like the.
Oh, I said if you want Apollo to go quiet, like in terms, like I would say it's quite loud in terms of its API usage.
Okay, like it's a very. Sorry, that's a complete misinterpretation.
Yeah, yeah. No, no, it's all good.
I apologize immediately.
No, it's all good.
Because what we're hearing in some conversations is folks are, you know. Like in other making threats, you're just like, hey, that's not a conversation that we want to have. So I immediately apologize.
No, it's all good. I'm sorry if it sounded like that.
I was asking you to repeat it, but I thought I misheard it.
No. I'm a noisy API user. No, like I said, I want this to be constructive as much as possible. And that would be the opposite.
Fantastic. Okay, I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you very much. I'm here. Please email at any time, and look forward to continuing to chat.
Yeah, likewise. Just shoot me an email as well if you folks want to talk. I'm here.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, good luck with any additional calls. Take care. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
So that happens, and he, I'm assuming, doesn't know that Christian recorded the call.
So was he making a threat?
That's the big debate now. I mean, yeah, he says it's mostly a joke. So Spez then goes on Reddit and says that Christian's threatening him, even though on the call he was acting like, oh, I immediately apologize. I completely misinterpreted that, like that had all been cleared up. But then he goes to Reddit and says that Apollo's threatening us. So then Christian's like, well, I have the recording of the call. He posts it. So anyway, it's just all this drama basically that was happening last year around this, where Redditors like really, really have a lot of anger and hatred towards Spez because of this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like kind of like a free labor issue here. It's similar to the Google story where it's like, oh, you're not really employed by Google. You know, mods are not necessarily employed by Reddit, but they're the reason Reddit is so successful, their labor. And obviously, I'm not saying that it's similar at all, because the contractors for Google, they have a real case to say like Google's actually our partial employer. But it's just a similar parallel where it's like it's our labor as mods that make your site successful. So the very least you could do is respect us when we tell you we don't like what you're doing and change things for us, because we should be the top of mind for you. And Spez's position is basically like, I watched a couple of interviews where he talks about it. It's like, okay, well, Reddit let people build on the API for free. And the reason for that is because, quote, we believe in the open internet. But what's happened, though, over the last 5-10 years is that these kind of small users of our API have themselves turned into massive users.
We've had this API, the one that people use for as long as I can remember on Reddit. And our reason for having it was really, look, we believe in the open internet. Right. And we thought giving access to Reddit in ways, in the ability to extend Reddit can't hurt. What's happened, though, over the last 5-10 years is these kind of small users of our API have themselves turned into massive users and at our expense, making millions of dollars. I think exploiting our data for their own financial gain, that's where we drew the line.
So he says that these apps are exploiting Reddit's data for their own financial gain, which is, of course, a little bit ironic also, because Reddit is exploiting user data now for their own financial gain. But we'll talk about that in a second. Spez says, quote, the average user doesn't give a shit about our business, nor do we expect them to. But our business is our business and Reddit is a business. And if we want to continue to exist, we need to stand on our own 2 feet. So we see them kind of pushing towards these decisions that put profit over the user experience, right?
Exactly. And so when this revolt happens, I it's so funny even like calling this a revolt. I feel like the peasants are taking over, but it's really just like these weirdos who are like
privating their subreddit.
Yeah, they're privating their subreddit. It's like they know how powerful they are. So they
So in response to the API pricing change, there's this blackout. 7,000 subreddits go dark.
Yeah, some of them shut down. And what Reddit did as a way forward, well, first of all, they sent a message. I have the message that they sent to the power users, to the mods. If there are mods who are unwilling to work towards reopening this community, we are willing to work with you to process a top mod removal request or reorder the mod team to achieve this goal if mods higher up the list are hindering reopening. So they're trying to say, like, we will divide and conquer. We would handle this request and any retaliation attempts here in this mod chain immediately. Our goal is to work with existing mod team to find a path forward and make sure your subreddit is made available for the community, which makes it its home here. If you are not able or willing to reopen and maintain the community, please let us know. So they sent out this kind of soft message, but what really happened was they just started removing mods and like replace those moderators with just like power users of the subreddit. And Ars Technica like talked to specific mods
which, by the way,
replaced.
It's owned by Condé Nast, but just show everything so incestuous.
Yeah, that's funny. Ars Technica is actually doing a great job reporting on this like turmoil. But yeah, what's interesting was that it wasn't just the big mods. It wasn't like the, you know, pics or news or it would go into these less popular niche Reddits like canning. They replaced the moderator. They were like, we need the canning subreddit. This is like people who put tomatoes in jars and stuff like that at home. There's so many things that can go wrong with canning. So the mod who was removed was like, I'm kind of worried people will die, you know, if they try to can milk. And, you know, there's a lot of people who just have fucked up ideas about canning, and they're kind of corrected on this Reddit because you have people with some modicum of experience. Yeah, and these moderators of canning like have like master's degrees and graduate degrees in science, you know, like they're actual experts. And yeah, home automation also another one where it's like, okay, you're rewiring electricity in your house. Well, there's a lot that can go wrong there too. So maybe we'll see the repercussions of the scramble for new moderators and what that will mean for like the 3D printing gun industry. And like,
I hate to even put this out there, but like, I could see a future where Reddit decides to just employ moderators for, I don't know, any page that has more than a certain amount of, are they called followers on Reddit? Community members, whatever, like,
yeah,
people who have joined the Reddit. Or the subreddit, rather, maybe that now becomes at least partially moderated by someone employed by Reddit, it would be a really far cry from the original Reddit. But yeah, I could almost see a future where that makes sense, especially when you're dealing with a publicly traded company where a bad day in the press could mean a giant dip in the stock price and stuff like that, you know? So anyway, the API pricing is like the biggest example that we have about like this move towards profitability for Reddit, right?
And yeah, and already we're seeing like such a revolt.
It's just crazy because it's like it's unpaid volunteer labor. And like your unpaid volunteers of mods are now protesting your dumb changes. And if you really cared about community, then you would reverse course. But of course, that's not what's driving decisions anymore. It's all about the investors, right? In the latest example of Reddit kind of doing this push towards profitability, we see them enter a data licensing deal with Google.
Well, in terms of AI, I thought one of the other things that was fascinating that happened yesterday was their announcing this plan to have a bigger partnership with Google, which effectively means we are going to start selling more of our data to train on, I believe, for AI purposes, for Google's purposes. So they're taking your information and selling it. How do you feel about that?
Look, trust me, if I'm Reddit, I'm going to Wall Street, and then that's the pitch completely. You go to Wall Street and you say, this is going to be our business. This will be the growth business. They could basically tell Wall Street investors, look, take a ride together with us and Sam Altman. We are an important element in the AI economy moving forward. And this is a good bet.
You have to think about Reddit as like one of the last places on the internet. Like, we're already experiencing the internet affected by generative AI and all these like bullshit articles that are written by chatbots. And Reddit is just one of the last places where people are having like real arguments on like what color the dress is, or they're finding the species of a plant, or, you know, people are having real discussions.
Yeah, Google is going to use Reddit data, like we said, to train its AI models and also improve Google search. So what we're probably going to see is, like, you know how when you search something on Google now, You get a carousel sometimes with tweets at the top in the search results. We'll probably see that with Reddit too. But I think the bigger thing is that Google is going to use all of this data to train its LLMs. And it's not even clear if users will be able to opt out from their data being used or not.
And it's not clear. Yeah, private messages are also game.
And Spez can understand how valuable his user data is when he's negotiating with Google, right? He's saying the Reddit corpus of data is really valuable. Reddit is a home for authentic conversation. There's a lot of stuff on the site that you'd only ever see in therapy or AA or never at all. Right? So he's saying we should be compensated by these LLMs that want to train their AI models.
We do deserve to be compensated, I think, for the role Reddit played in creating these models, which was significant. We believe we should be compensated for the use of that data. You know, at Reddit, we've long talked about a data business. It's just not something we've actively pursued until now. We have this massive corpus that gets updated every day of people's opinions about pretty much everything. And I think there's a lot of value in that.
So Reddit wants to be compensated for like all of these communities, right? But like who really built those fucking legendary communities? Like the mods built the communities, right? So this kind of brings us to, I think, one of the main flashpoints of Reddit kind of getting bigger and becoming the establishment as it gets bigger, right? Because obviously the bigger you get, the more you start having to think about how Reddit can be a tool of power, right? Because again, one of the most visited sites on the internet, you're going to have influence over the way that people think and feel about things, right?
I mean, we've seen Reddit degrade in a number of ways, and it's going to decay even faster going forward. And one way we saw Reddit kind of degrade in its content was when they hired the director of policy, a position that they kind of made up in 2017.
Yeah, Jessica Hachu.
Jessica Hsu, the director of policy, who has also worked in different areas of the government, the State Department, the Atlantic Council. She has like the resume of somebody that every leftist is just like, oh, this person is fishy. Like they clearly have an agenda.
As Discount Master 5933 on our conspiracy notebook, yeah. Atlantic Council ties should always raise a red flag. And as Adhesive Lanky 638 put it in our late stage imperialism, quote, if you're wondering why Reddit is creeping with pro-Israel accounts, Reddit's director of policy is Jessica Hsu, a former U.S. state official and an aggressive wonk at Atlantic Council, the brain of NATO, funded by the U.S. military and more. I feel like it's only right for us to quote Redditors in this episode.
Yeah, it's only right. And yeah, I was like lurking on the combat footage Reddit subreddit, and it was just like all Ukrainian soldiers, like from the Ukrainian point of view. And they actually posted that you can't post any footage from the Hamas point of view.
I mean, like, our world news has been banning pro-Palestinian users for years. Why do you have someone who worked at NATO's unofficial think tank, who served as deputy director for Madeleine Albright and NSA advisor Stephen Hadley's Middle East Strategy Task Force at the Atlantic Council, work at Reddit, right? She's not there to learn about, is this bug a bed bug? Like, she's there to help curate information. Because again, like we said, you can't have 76 million visiting your site daily without NATO wanting to make sure nothing too anti-NATO was on there, you know?
And when Jessica Hsu took office as the director of policy, I mean, do you want to get into her CV a little bit? How she was so pro-regime change in Syria? And there's an interview with her on Al Jazeera, and she's talking about how good the airstrikes are on Syria.
Oh, yeah. She praised the government's decision to bomb Syria. She was like, oh, finally, the British public is, quote, coming around to the idea of war.
Yeah, and really believed, you know, drank the Kool-Aid at the time that Assad was going to be easy to get out and easy to unseat. And wow, how those people were really proven wrong and really made the Syrian conflict more deadly. So like the battle for Aleppo was all, you know, was the casualty number was is over Gaza, even though it didn't get the same kind of, you know, publicity. Mm-hmm. But a big part of that was American arms were in there causing more death.
And, you know, like, this is not really to single out one person. It's just an example. Like, we don't know which of Reddit's decisions she's behind and exactly what role she plays behind closed doors, right? But she did lead policy, and she was basically tapped to be, like, the anti-fake news warrior, right? And I think we all can, at this point, 2024, we all can understand that the crusade against fake news, like, what has it done, right? It does nothing to counter mainstream media biased and fake reporting, and it's always about countering more dissident reporting, right? That's
The main thing was like, oh, Democrats believe that, the Democratic Party believe that only people misled by Russian memes could like Donald Trump.
Could like and Donald that Trump.
Was, could, yeah, and
all this other stuff too. It got kind of like everything, of course, got overshadowed by the Trump stuff. But they were saying before that they were saying that Russia's influencing people to be anti-cop. They were saying Russian-linked accounts are criticizing NATO, are criticizing, what was it, the war in Syria. The only way you could be against the war in Syria is if you have a Russian-linked account. We saw, you know, fake news crusades hit Facebook, and, you know, all these foreign policy and hawkish think tanks were involved in the curation of social media platforms. And we saw all these like anti-police brutality pages get taken down, anti-war pages. It's all this dissident stuff, right? That you could say would get quote unquote swept up, but I think that's even too forgiving. I don't think it was swept up like it was an accident, right? The ruling class doesn't want people talking about NATO and talking about the cops and talking about, you know, drone strikes and stuff like that.
Even in an ironic way. So like Chapo Trap House Reddit got banned when Jessica Hsu took office.
Right. And so in the capacity of director of policy for Reddit, she oversees all global government relations and public policy for the company, in addition to content, product, and advertising policy. Also, she was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations Middle East Strategy Task Force to have people from these hawkish think tanks, which, you know, Atlantic Council, Council on Foreign Relations. There's interlocks between, you know, weapons contractors, oil companies, giant corporations, the CIA, stuff like that. And there's also literally the money, right? Like the Atlantic Council is funded by NATO, the Pentagon, and then just like a bunch of major corporations, including quote unquote defense contractors, right? So what is their policy going to be on U.S. military involvement and on war, right? It's going to be pro-war. And it's all going to be pro-Western imperial. Like, it's the West. It's like Council on Foreign Relations. Like, it's not an international body, right? Like, this is a U.S. institution. It's going to be, you know, very skewed towards the U.S. empire, because that's the empire we're living under right now. Sorry.
I mean, now it's more important than ever to be worried about this stuff when it comes to Israel and Palestine. So we're seeing Reddit totally the timeline get cleansed,
like censorship of debate, dissent, like totally against. I mean, you know, Aaron Swartz would be rolling in his grave, right? It's just so against the original ideas of Reddit, which was like, remember, like the whole point, even to this day, Spez says that like the mainstream media sucks, right? But does the mainstream media suck because that's just how things go? Was it just born sucking? No, the mainstream media sucks because of the profit motives behind them, right? They suck because they take money from, again, defense contractors, oil companies, like pharma companies, whatever it is. So to say like mainstream media sucks, that's why we made Reddit, but now you're going public and you're putting profit over people just like the mainstream media did, is just like, it's ironic. It's not surprising because obviously this is going to happen to any big company, but it's just ironic.
I mean, a lot of people are, you know, saying that Reddit is going to go the way of Twitter, and Twitter is just like kind of the canary in the coal mine, to whereas, you know, you could have some sort of discussion on Twitter before, but now, you know, it's like pussy and bio and You know, here's an unrelated group of animals having a really romantic friendship, and you know, it's just totally irrelevant comments.
Yeah. Before we leave Jessica Hsu, I forgot to mention real quick, she does flying trapeze.
Yeah, she's kind of cool. If she didn't have the CV that she had, she seems like she's like living her best life. Her husband has one leg, so he's not going anywhere.
But her cat has three legs.
Her cat has three legs.
Or is it dog? I think it's
the cat has three legs. Yeah.
Right. So anyway, according to the Atlanta Council, as director of policy for Reddit, a big part of what she does, I mean, you know, there's obviously fake news, like we said, and all that, but she also works against online terrorist recruiting. And what is a terrorist to the Atlanta Council and its ilk, right? Like to the people who supported the war on Syria, Iraq, and all of that stuff. Like, what is a terrorist? It's someone posting
Professor Mearsheimer.
It's someone posting Israel shouldn't have killed those kids. That's what terrorism is right now to these people. And I mean, terrorism has always served empire. The whole concept of terrorism is obviously shitty and fake.
What we can imagine is that like Violent Anchors, Michael Brooch has been replaced by a shoe. Like instead of a troll running the site and creating these subreddits, we have like a hawkish regime change apologist cleansing the timeline of anything sympathetic to Palestine.
You know, it just makes what he did, doesn't it, recast what he did a little bit?
Don't you miss Chokovich?
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I guess in conclusion, Aaron's definitely rolling in his grave.
Yeah, that's such a sad story. Oh my god, I like cried.
Yeah, I mean, the real story of Aaron is what he did after Reddit. After Reddit, he became an activist and he became just like an awesome person, you know?
And I think it's important to keep in mind that like Bill Gates, you know, started his company on the Harvard computers, violating terms of services. Steve Jobs and Wozniak created that blue box to like defraud the phone company and make phone calls without them. And these people were lauded as geniuses, but that's because they didn't write a guerrilla manifesto, you know,
right?
They weren't,
because they didn't have politics, right?
Yeah.
So Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, whatever, it was literally just, I just want to have a successful business and make money. But Aaron grew up to be a very politically engaged activist. he did not fuck with, you know, just making a company and cashing out. Like, he wanted to change the world. And that's where you start to become an enemy of the state. You know, Bill Gates, okay, he broke a law, but he's never going to be an enemy of the state.
And yeah, I mean, it wasn't clear that Aaron was that, he wasn't really that much of a threat. They just wanted to make an example of him.
He wasn't much of a actual financial threat to MIT or to JSTOR, but he was a threat in terms of his influence, because he really galvanized people. He was part of this movement that was really, yeah, it wasn't him as an individual that was a threat, but the movement. They needed to make an example of someone to stop the movement that he was part of.
Yeah, there's also that story of like, there was like a teenager who used his JSTOR leaked articles to find an early test for pancreatic cancer, you know, like just like this is what you'd make up as like, oh, imagine a teen, you know, some poor person finds a cure for cancer, but it's like actually that did happen. Like, not a cure, but like the most deadly cancers can be like detected more easily because of this open access to information. It just doesn't, it doesn't make any sense to quarantine publicly funded research. But anyways, where were we on Jessica?
I'll quote another Reddit user. He's responding to people kind of talk Jessica.
We can't speak for the users themselves. We need to quote them.
It's only right. He's responding to, you know, a post about Jessica and her influence. As Anarcho Appalachia put it in our socialism, Quote, this is how ideology reproduces. Key positions decide which values are amplified, and as a result, people with less free time to do research and self-education fall into this being the more common norm. Boom, average proletarian is too overworked to do the research and ends up becoming an instrument of the state. Couldn't have put
Hell
it
yeah.
anarcho-Appalachia. But yeah, this is the thing is like, you know, we can laugh about like Reddit, using Reddit for vacuums, and it's like a product review site and like a TV spoiler site, whatever. But these giant platforms shape hearts and minds in the aggregate. As a listener, you're like, well, that wouldn't change my mind. But like a lot of people are not super politically engaged. They just want like a taste of world news every now and then. And this kind of platform can completely shape that for them.
Exactly.
Oh, I have one more. Mono Pronto asked in our DSA, is this why I see so many bloodthirsty warmongers on our world news? This is also in response to someone posting about Jessica Hsu. So the whole censorship issue is the last key aspect of this, right? Of Reddit becoming the establishment as it got bigger. So they're monetizing everything. And, you know, within that monetization package, we have, you know, running ads, starting to charge for the API, a content deal with Google. Ironically, the content that it got for free from moderators who worked for free, but now they're getting paid for it from Google. And, you know, just being profit driven in general. That's one way they became the establishment. And then the second way is, unfortunately, this like propaganda censorship issue, because you just can't get this big without becoming the establishment, as Steve Huffman pointedly said in his own words.
Yeah. And I think we're going to see even more tighter speech on Reddit, because Aaron Bushnell was one of those people who was really active on Reddit and talked about his views on Palestine there. So we're going to see more of that, I think. Oh, and then there was like a fake screenshot of him talking on Reddit, saying Palestine will be free when all the Jews are dead.
With the Israel-Palestine thing, like, you need to censor on behalf of Israel in order to kind of keep the machine running. There's too many things to see. There's just like too much evidence that if it were just completely natural and everything was just sorted in an organic way, everyone would be pro-Palestine. This kind of stuff needs extreme levels of censorship.
Like, yeah, like the video of the flower massacre, like you can't have people looking at that and picking it apart, just people getting shot at for while they're trying to get food. That's not something that, you know, people are going to see and walk away with good feelings about Israel with, you know?
Yeah. And you need to fabricate things like Aaron Bushnell's fake post, Palestine will be free when all the Jews are dead.
Are you surprised that somebody did this after, you know, watching months and months of, you know, just people getting annihilated? And
And also he, I'm sure you saw, like, because he was active U.S. military, like, he had information that even we don't have. Like, obviously, we've seen the atrocities and we've seen the horrors and the casualties. But he knows on an even deeper level what's going on. He was part of it. He was doing, I think, DevOps. Yeah, I mean, he saw it with his own fucking eyes.
Yeah. I don't know. That was also a sad story.
Yeah, extremely sad. I mean, add on a sad note.
Can't get any darker than somebody self-immolating.
Crazy. And then there was the whole conversation around, you know, he's mentally ill and we shouldn't be glorifying this. And it's like, you know what's fucking mentally ill? To kill tens of thousands of people. The perspective is so lacking sometimes. And that's why censorship is, I'm just trying to bring it back to Reddit. But that actually is why it is kind of like the defining issue of our time, because some of these people, some of the people that are pro-Israel, pro-war, whatever it is, all these horrible opinions to hold, a lot of the time they are working off incomplete and inaccurate information. You know, most people think human life is valuable and all of that, right? But propaganda is so pervasive. I mean, obviously, we're in the heart of the empire. Of course, it's going to be super strong here. But propaganda is so pervasive where people are just working off different sets of facts.
I don't know. Yeah, it's not that hard to find the good stuff. It's just like Reddit is not going to be one of those avenues.
For you, because you know what you're looking for, yes. But I also think that, again, a big part of propaganda is what you don't show. So if you're on Our World News every day or whatever the fuck it is, reading the New York Times, reading Vice or whatever, and you're just seeing, you know, reporting about the Golden Globes and you're seeing, you know, this thing about a Republican senator saying something about a trans bathroom, and then you see, you know, news about the stock market and whatever, you're just not going to start asking these questions about Israel. I'm not to make excuses for people who are propagandized, but it's just, it's an institutional issue. Oh yeah, next week we're doing Vice. Rest in peace to Vice. So if you have ever worked at Vice, please email us at cargocultpod@gmail.com.
Oh my God, you know what's funny? A Vice journalist reached out to me when I was RT laid us off. So should I reach out to him about his
Oh, wait, yes, you definitely should. That's hilarious.
Ask him to come on the pod.
Yes, please come on the pod. As a treat to him, he can ask us anything about RT. He still cares.